This week on Behind the Lens. Charters for two New Orleans schools will not be renewed next year, and one of those schools will return to Orleans Parish School Board control. Marta Jusen has the story. Also, the governing board of the Montreal Convention Center deferred a vote to approve an architect for a $500 million capital improvement plan. Michael Isaac Stein explains. And 2 months after the Hard Rock Hotel construction collapse, local unions and community members are petitioning City Hall, demanding better laws to protect workers. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
This year's state assessment of charter schools had both Mary D. Coghill and Joseph A. Craig receiving failing grades, leading NOLA Public Schools Superintendent Henderson Lewis to recommend against renewing those charters. At an Orleans Parish School Board meeting on Thursday, members were set to either support Lewis's recommendation or overturn it. Lens Education reporter Marta Jusen has been following this story. Marta, bring us up to speed on the procedure here. The school superintendent makes a recommendation, and then the school board has the ultimate decision?
Correct. So this is actually, things have changed a bit in the last couple of years. What used to happen is the board would make all these decisions, and now the superintendent does it, and only if they want to challenge his recommendation do board members take a vote, and does the public actually get to comment. So that's what happened. At a previous board meeting, Board President John Brown promised the public that he would bring it up for a vote. So it was actually a motion to reject superintendent's recommendations. So we heard a lot of public comment last night, a lot of passion. People want these charter schools to stay under their current leadership, but the board in the end couldn't actually muster the 5 votes needed out of the 7-member board to overturn those recommendations, which means that Coghill and Craig will be under new leadership next year.
So looking at this from sort of a procedural standpoint, the board president, John Brown, the fact that he even brought it up for consideration at the meeting, did that signify that he was going to vote to overturn Henderson's recommendation?
Not necessarily, but he seemed to do it more as a point of saying that he was going to let the public speak on this issue to the board. As a teacher and a principal, he was very empathetic to the students and the teachers and parents who came to speak. He did end up voting in support of keeping both schools under current leadership, but I don't know if that was necessarily his plan going in.
And keeping both schools under current leadership, so he voted against Henderson's recommendation.
Correct. So that was, I would say, a very confusing part of this meeting, is that like a yes vote was actually to reject the superintendent. So people were definitely confused throughout the meeting. There was also one point where it was really hard to hear what the board members were saying. I even stood up at that point and said, you guys, we got to do a roll call vote here. No one can understand what you're saying. So when they went down the line for Coghill School, which got a little bit closer to staying under their current board, the vote ended up being 4-2 in support of rejecting the superintendent's recommendation, which would mean that Coghill would stay under its current board. And I think some people were a little confused because 4 does represent a majority of the board, but it's not enough. It has to be 5.
Okay, so a majority of the board voted to keep Coghill under current leadership, which went against Henderson Lewis's recommendation, but the vote count didn't reach the threshold of overturning the recommendation. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. How many board members are there?
There are 7 members on the school board, but last night there were only 6 board members present. Sarah Usden was absent due to a family emergency. So kind of going into these votes, it was already going to be, you know, probably difficult to get 5 out of 6 people to vote in that one way.
And what was the vote on Joseph A. Craig?
Joseph Craig didn't get as much support as Coghill did. Only 2 board members voted to reject the superintendent's recommendation, so that vote was 2-4, and it also failed. So what this means for the 2 schools, Superintendent Lewis also announced new plans last night, is that Craig will go to a new charter group. There are 2 groups currently in the running, and I would expect that we'll hear more about that in January. And Coghill, which actually had 4 groups interested in taking it over, but none of them are interested anymore, and one of them is unqualified to run the school. That means Coghill is going to become a direct-run school, so the Orleans Parish School Board will no longer be an all-charter district next year.
So you said that one of the reasons this was even brought up for a vote of the school board was to give the public a chance to weigh in. What was the mood like in the room? How many people showed up and what did they have to say?
The room was absolutely packed. There were, I would guess, about 250 people in there, standing room only. Not only were there supporters from Coghill and Craig each separately, but there's a group called Step Up Louisiana who had showed up. They had held a separate rally. The group generally supports, you know, a living wage and better schools and these type of things. So they had separately marched over and they came in and filled the room basically to capacity, or probably over capacity, let's be honest. There's a ton of media also there. This board meeting came a day after the bus crash on I-10 where a bus overturned. So people were, I would say, very much interested in both these two charters, and they wanted to hear a response from the superintendent about what he's going to do about school bus safety. Lewis didn't talk much about bus safety. He said he's having his staff look into other policy options and potentially restricting charter schools to only using certain operators, which would be a very big development in terms of charter autonomy. But the main news of the evening was these two votes on the charters and whether or not to keep them under current leadership. I would say the crowd was very impatient at times. The district didn't necessarily quite explain that there was going to be a presentation before people would get to speak. Both Coghill and Craig supporters said that they were essentially blindsided by this 30-page report that Superintendent Lewis's staff presented to the board. While there was a lot of academic data and compliance issues that people already knew about, there was also some new stuff like a special ed review at Craig. Craig supporters said, "You made our recommendation in November to take our charter away. Why are you using this stuff from December?"
Yeah, perhaps that new information was maybe sort of to reinforce Henderson's decision.
It certainly was. I guess I can understand their frustration potentially, but yeah, it was to reinforce his recommendation, especially in front of his board when his board is questioning his recommendation.
And we talked about a couple of weeks ago when we were discussing that these schools received failing grades and that Henderson was recommending against renewing the charters. We discussed how a lot of families really seemed to want these schools, especially Coghill, to stay open. So what did parents have to say last night?
There were many parents who wanted their schools to stay open under current leadership. One parent in particular got up and she said, "You know, I have four boys. Three of my boys have had their school close in the last 3 years." So that was, I think, hit particularly hard for people. Even if a school is not performing well, parents generally don't want to see this overturn every year. It means a new staff comes in. And, you know, there was a couple students who said, "You can't keep changing things. Like, you're changing things all the time. You can't close stuff on us." Or, you know, one student said, I've been at Coghill for 8 years and I want to graduate from there. It's a K-8 school. So John Brown, who, you know, as an educator, I think greatly empathized with everyone in the room, he, after the meeting in an interview, told me, you know, "We've got to look at maybe a better way to do this, just in terms of not making the community feel like schools are being uprooted every single year, especially when a lot of the same students and staff are going to be in those schools the following year."
And regarding that mother who said she had that three of her four kids had had their schools shut down, you know, sort of repeatedly, that kind of seems to me to tie into the whole school choice situation and the one app process, that a family might sort of be stuck with some of these lower performing schools really being their only option based on availability, based on performance of their students. You know, I'm not really surprised that one family might have gotten sort of stuck in a cycle of attending schools that wind up failing and then get shut down.
Yeah, I think when you're a more mobile student, if your school is being closed, for example, you know, you are potentially more likely to go to another school that is not the highest performing in the district, just because high performing schools are full. People want to be there and they stay there.
So to wrap this all up, Superintendent Henderson Lewis recommended against renewing the charters for both Coghill and Craig. The school board was unable to overturn that recommendation, and the charter groups that were initially interested in taking over Coghill's charter have all, for one reason or another, backed out or become ineligible, putting Coghill under Orleans Parish School Board leadership for the 2020-2021 school year.
Yeah, and Nolan Marshall, who was one of the board members, at the end he said, "You know, I actually welcome this opportunity to be more involved with running schools and in children's education." So the Orleans Parish School Board will once again be running a school.
taking away New Orleans' position as an all-charter network. Marta Jusen, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
The governing board of the Ernest N. Morial Convention Center has again deferred a vote to approve an architect for its $557 million capital improvement plan. The decision came down to concerns over the inclusion or lack of minority-owned businesses. Len's staff reporter Michael Isaac Stein has been following the story. So, Michael, what's the background here? Why was the vote deferred the first time?
So, yeah, again, like you said, this is for a executive architect for the convention center's big, big $500 million 5-year capital plan that they're starting to wade into right now. The staff had put out a request for qualifications for this position. They got 3 responses, but they ended up choosing one. This firm called Populous. It's a huge, huge firm. They've done convention center projects all over the world. And that was the recommendation they brought to the board. And so in November, it was kind of expected that that vote would go pretty smoothly. But they ended up deferring the vote over 2 issues. The first was a legal question over whether the format of the contract was actually legally enforceable. That ended up being resolved. But the second issue was the fact that Populous is a large firm. It's not minority owned. And it's from out of state. It's a Missouri-based firm. And that second set of issues were one that you saw pop up again during the December meeting.
So that's the background of what happened at the November meeting. Why was this vote deferred again at this most recent meeting in December?
So it was an interesting debate because although they deferred a vote on this specific contract, the conversation itself kind of broadened to how the convention center includes minority-owned businesses or small businesses in general. Basically, the concerns that were brought up was the fact that nowhere in this, you know, request for qualifications did the convention center put a goal or requirement that there would be, you know, the involvement of minority-owned businesses. And those concerns were brought up in November. So during this meeting, the staff came back with a plan. So basically what they said is, this is a $4 million contract. But that's only a fraction of the roughly $22 million that we plan to spend on architectural services for this whole plan. So they said, although this contract is not going to a minority business, we're, you know, going to set a goal of giving 30% of all these architectural contracts to minority-owned businesses or small businesses. Howard, that didn't quite satisfy all the critics. There were questions, first of all, about how Populous won through this process. A lot of people questioned why Populous wasn't asked to maybe partner with a local firm or bring them onto the team, you know, for the project. And at the meeting, one of the founders of a black-owned architecture firm, Hewitt Washington and Associates, he had come to the meeting and he told the Lens that he had actually never heard about the RFQ, the request for qualifications. And you know, if he had, he might have, you know, approached Populous to try and partner with them. So the whole conversation was really about, did we do enough with this contract? Did the convention center really do enough with this contract to try and get it to a minority-owned firm?
Yeah, minority-owned and a local firm. You know, there's a lot of conversation about big city contracts going to support local firms. Was this request for qualifications process maybe not as transparent and open as it could have been?
You know, it's interesting. Talking to people on the board and talking to people who have really been around the convention center for a while, what they'll say is that over the past few years, the convention center has really tried to move from acting as like a private organization to trying to fulfill its role as a public institution that gets, you know, tens of millions of dollars in tax revenue every year. And so, you know, I think that there are critiques about the openness of the RFP, RFQ processes and how they source their contracts at the convention center. But you'll also hear people say that there has been a massive improvement from where we were 10 years ago, for example. And I think the same thing applies to inclusion of minority businesses. So the founder, Mr. Hewitt from Hewitt Washington and Associates, after the meeting, we, you know, I talked to him and his big takeaway, he was disappointed that he wasn't involved in this contract, but, you know, he was very enthusiastic and about the fact that there was a conversation at all. You know, the fact that the convention center board spent over an hour discussing the best way to include minority businesses and how they would achieve that, in his eyes, he was saying that, you know, that itself is a massive improvement. Although, of course, there's still work to be done. But yeah, you know, in terms of how these contracts are divvied out, there's always been concerns about the secrecy of that process when it comes to the convention center.
So we've got this Missouri-based firm, Populous, that has been recommended by convention center staff to receive this contract for capital improvements at the convention center. The vote by the board has been deferred twice. What happens now?
Yeah, so I think the reason why they deferred ultimately in this during the December meeting was that they wanted to see if the staff could come back and really show the board how they were going to meet that 30% goal for the remaining architecture contracts. There was discussion about creating what's called a set-aside for minority businesses instead of a goal. So a set-aside is an explicit percentage of the contracts that would have to go to minority or small businesses. The trouble there and the reason why the convention center says they didn't do that to begin with is that those have consistently seen legal challenges, especially in Louisiana. And so it's not always easy to actually cement, you know, a set aside, you know, legally. You know, they're going to have to bring this up again at the January meeting. And I think, you know, the way the staff is going to try and resolve it is not by changing the Populous contract, but trying to assure the board that for the rest of the contracts, they're going to change the process and take the inclusion of minority businesses more seriously.
Michael Isaac Stein, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
Months ago, the collapse of the Hard Rock Hotel construction site left three people dead, dozens injured, and a worksite whistleblower deported. Demolition of the building is likely to take several months, and developers are seeking a permit to demolish three adjacent buildings, a request the Central Business District Landmarks Commission is likely to weigh in on early next month.
It is our duty to win!
It is our duty to win!
Labor unions and community groups in New Orleans held a rally at City Hall on Thursday evening to demand better working conditions at construction sites in response to the collapse.
We need answers and we need accountability.
They're calling for new regulations on contractors that receive city money and increased inspections of potentially dangerous work sites throughout the city. Organizers say some of the demands require passing new laws, while others can be addressed by strengthening existing laws. For example, New Orleans has a responsible bidder ordinance already on the books. But Julian Burns with the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice says the law needs to be enforced.
So this is sort of a wake-up call where, you know, the unions in particular are really pushing for, okay, this is the moment to get an updated responsible bidder ordinance passed that's actually going to have an impact on who gets money.
The workers are also seeking protections for whistleblowers and undocumented immigrants like Delmar Yoel Ramirez Palma, who spoke publicly about unsafe conditions at the construction site and was deported shortly after the collapse. Ramirez Palma's wife, Tanya, addressed the crowd at City Hall.
No se me hizo justo.
To me, it's a very deep injustice that instead of supporting my husband when he tried to come forward, OSHA didn't do anything.
Bring Joel home! Bring Joel home!
Demonstrators called for Ramirez Palma to be brought back to the United States so that he can be reunited with his family and fully participate as a key witness in the investigation of the hotel collapse. Ramirez Palma's deportation has drawn national attention, particularly because there are legal protections for whistleblowers in cases like these. The Department of Labor and the Department of Homeland Security have what's called a deconflation memo that should protect people involved in an active investigation from being deported. It's unclear why that federal protection didn't postpone the deportation of Ramirez Palma, but local labor organizations are asking the city council to work on whistleblower protections at the municipal level and hope the newly formed Human Rights Commission will take up that issue. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be off next week, but we'll return on Friday, January 4th, 2020. In the meantime, please consider supporting independent journalism in New Orleans. The Lens is participating in Newsmatch, a national matching gift campaign that drives donations to nonprofit newsrooms like us around the country. And readers like you can play a key role in keeping our newsroom strong. From now through December 31st, Newsmatch will match every new monthly donation 12 times and double any one-time donation up to $1,000. For a nonprofit like us, this is a big deal and will help us deliver the kind of innovative journalism you've come to expect every day. This news can't wait, so why would you? Donate today at thelensnola.org/donate, and thank you.